Welcome to season two of Career Resilience, where we talk with people about their career path and their career journey, and maybe we can all learn from each other. My name is Jan Daniluk, and I'm a human resources consultant in London, Ontario, Canada. I work with Ford Keast LLP, providing human resources advice and counsel to my business clients. I also support people through individual one-on-one coaching in helping with career development. I hope you will enjoy our series where we talk with ordinary, extraordinary people. We get to hear about interesting journeys. We get to talk with people about failures, successes, advice, and counsel to us as we develop our own careers. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with these people, and I hope you will enjoy listening to it. And now for some logistics. Please subscribe on YouTube, or if you're a listener, please follow me wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a chance, I hope you'll visit my website, career-resilience.com. Welcome. My guest today is Ken Kirkpatrick. Ken, welcome to Career Resilience.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure, it really is. And we have so much to talk about today. We're going to chat about your career in the police as a police officer and your career progression. And that's a lot of what we're about here on Career Resilience. And we're also going to chat about how things went sideways for you in terms of health. So that's sort of our combination of discussion today. So I always like to start with where people are physically located. So I see that you're located in a room, but in the room, yes. In what city?
I'm in Hamilton, Ontario.
Yes. Okay. And that's the police force that you work within.
Yes. So I'm a Hamilton Police Service officer.
Yes. Okay. So let's start with talking a little bit. Let's just get right into your career. So you are a police officer, and I wanted to know, did you always know that's where you wanted to go with your career?
No. You know what? I didn't really know what I wanted to do. Out of high school, I knew that I wanted to be in computers. So I ended up going to college for computer programming, and I loved it. I just loved being able to tell the program to do something, and it did it for me, and it made me happy. Then I got some job experience in computer programming, and I found myself in a cubicle, and I wasn't talking to people. I was just kind of eyes in the screen, and mentally I was exhausted, but physically I was like, I had a lot of energy, and just like that contradiction that clashed. It was very difficult to get out and go for a run and be physically active the way I wanted to be. It didn't lead to the lifestyle that I was looking for. I needed something much more, social. And I guess like eventually my career as a police officer kind of morphed into computers anyway, but, that's what I needed. I needed that social. I needed to talk to people. So
was that was a kind of big shock for you, or you just thought, oh, I'm young enough, it doesn't matter, I can just sort of pop over and do something different?
Yeah. Well, it was through a co-op that I found out that this was not, like, which was wonderful. It was great. It was actually in London at Fanshawe College, where I was doing the computer programmer. And It was great. It was a great co-op. I got to do programming, like very, very good stuff, but it was definitely an eye opener. And I was able to I had a year to pivot into my next choice, which was university. My parents were very like, you need to make sure that you have education to back you up so that, you can take care of yourself. And especially the way the market was going at that time. And now you need to be competitive, right? So, I ended up going to King's University College Western, and I did sociology and criminology. And I knew that, like, maybe I'd go in that route, but the criminology, those courses just, they spoke to me also. Mm-hmm. And I was just like deviance, I thought it was so great. It was so interesting to study that topic. And then the real world application of sociology and criminology for me, became policing.
Okay. And at the same time, did you do martial arts and stuff like that? You were a very physically active sort of person, right? Growing up and so on.
From a young age, I was into martial arts. And that's what filled, like, I think, you know, whenever I look back at my youth and I feel old saying looking back at my youth, but, you know, I look back at my youth and a lot of it was, you know, going to karate class. And then from a young age, really, I was teaching class too. You know, and that kind of like reiterates that social part that I need, you know, standing up at the front of the class and, you know, like leading a class. Right. And it was great. I think like the leadership part of where I was going in my life started really young with my instructors allowing me to teach.
Yeah.
But
So did you get, I don't know. I'm, can you just tell by looking at me, I'm not into martial arts, but did you get a green belt and a black belt and the belts you're supposed to get or?
Yeah. I got all the belts, you know, whenever I was younger, I was too young to go straight to a black belt. So there was like a junior black belt, which assists you in like kind of bridging that time of like, you know, you need to be a little bit older to get your black belt. Then I eventually got my black belt and continued teaching, competing across Canada and the States. And it was really awesome. It was a great pastime, you know, and it really instilled so many good things, especially like, you know, I'm thinking about my daughter too, that like, I would want my daughter to go into martial arts because of not even the physical stuff. It was the mental stuff that just kind of hardening, the repetitive, nature of like every class starting off with like a mantra of like keeping your thoughts positive, your words positive and your actions positive, because that all leads to your values and then your values become your destiny and all these things, right? Like it instilled such great values that if I could kind of steer my daughter in any way right now, I'd love to have her in martial arts. So, yeah.
So you would chalk up the person you are to a great extent to going through all those programs, to going through the martial arts.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's so many variables that can contribute to the makeup of someone, but like, you know, those hard values, you know, working hard, you know, having an empty gas tank, but still going as hard as you can, is so very important. And I think, you know, those experiences came out of martial arts also, right?
Yeah. So Ken, here we are in university, you're really liking these criminology courses. Is that when you said, aha?
I was looking for an aha moment, you know, where it was like, you know, policing or bust, right? But I think policing was the big, like, this is where it could happen, right? And I really thought that, you know, especially because, you know, with the martial arts background, I mean, physically, I knew that I would be okay. But I mean, martial arts kind of teaches you the opposite, that like, you don't need to be physical, right? Like, it gives you the confidence to be present, but it allows you to use communication like to the fullest, right? And I think that really fit with my idea of policing, which really turned out to be like, that was an aha moment where, you know, communication was very, very important in policing. So, it kind of evolved into policing. So, yeah.
Being the thought. Now, policing is very difficult to get into.
Yeah. It took me actually 3 years, actually just short of 3 years to get hired. And, you know, whenever I got that call and, hey, you're going to the Ontario Police College, you know, next week, that was a big moment for me. That was a huge moment. Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine. So you became a police officer in Hamilton. And so my question for you is, were you on the beat? Did you start out on the beat? And then I think to myself, is that the phrase that you would use, or is that just me watching TV?
You know what? Yeah, totally the phrase that I would use. Okay. So, you know, I got hired and they put me on the street, and my division was the central division. And within that division, there are little cutouts of beats. And so that's where, you know, you've got like a regular officer kind of hanging out, I guess, or patrolling in one certain area. So that's where the beat comes from. So like, it's cop lingo for beat. Yeah. So you're definitely hitting it.
Okay. So I'm watching the right TV shows, which yeah. leads me to ask, is it like what I see on TV? I don't mean that I don't actually watch the police reality shows, but I mean more the fictional shows.
In, you know, the 30 minutes or the hour of the TV show for a crime to happen and everything kind of get wrapped up, including, you know, victim interviews and things like that. You know, that aside, you know, some of the darker, grittier ones, the more the realistic ones are, you know, they focus a lot on the victim, and that's very realistic in times. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff that just kind of gets pushed under the carpet quickly. But yeah, I still watch the policing shows because it's fun to watch. And then I can critique and, you know, have discussions. Right?
Yeah. So was it what you expected?
No. I don't think anything could prepare you for being a police officer. Like, I don't think you can have that expectation of the experiences that you're going to come into contact with, you know, really speaking with victims and empathizing with the victim or even just speaking with the community at their worst time, because often, like, I mean, we're not dealing with people on their greatest days, you know. It's always the worst moments of people's lives where police often are called in and have to interact with them. And you have to remember that, because people are not going to be at their best, right? And that's where the communication comes in. Like, you must be a good communicator to operate in this policing career, right? Yeah. Especially in today's age, right? No, there was nothing. Like, I had no idea what I was getting into looking back. But now I'm looking back at like my patrol career, and I'm just like, I look back at it and I smile. I'm like, that was great, you know? And I truly think that I made an impact. You know, there's a lot of people that were affected in a positive way. Right. So yeah. That's a really takeaway.
Yeah. And so having all those experiences coming at you and even not being what you expected, what did you do to sort of cope with that and stay strong?
Well, so that is something that I was prepared for. And you know what, like, just to maybe just kind of open up being prepared, it's knowing that there are going to be situations that police officers get into that are going to be intense, right? There's going to be death, there's going to be assaults, there's going to be some good times, but there's going to be things that affect you. And I knew that going in. I knew that there was going to be a lot of challenges, especially with mental health and really taking care of yourself, right? And I think that would be the most important thing that anyone coming into policing would have to have a plan for their mental health, like a strategy, you know, building your support network, right? My mom, she was a community nurse. And so she kind of did the same thing as me, you know, like patrolled around Hamilton and did her job. So she had that idea, like she had been to places that I was going to be going, right? And so I was able to kind of like talk with her, hey, I went here and I saw this and this was terrible. And she's like, yeah, you know, and having someone to kind of talk and they know about it, that's huge.
Yeah.
It's really big. In having like a strategy to deal with these landmines that you kind of step on. But yeah. The strategy is to talk about it, you know, as much as you can. And, yeah. You know, my partner, she is phenomenal. Like, wow. Like, you know, whenever I have those difficult situations, just being able to talk with her and have her listen, you know, not necessarily comment or maybe explain away. It's that ear that you need, you know. I lucked out I really lucked out.
Yeah, oh, that's nice. I have a feeling she lucked out too. Okay, so what happened then in your career progression? You moved beyond the role of being a patrolling police officer.
Yeah. So there was this opportunity that came up where a new position was created, and it was the cybercrime unit. And that was a big aha moment for me. And that was, I'm a police officer, and I've got this computer background, right? And I had already become and kind of established myself as a bit of like, if you have any technical issues, you know, Kirkpatrick's the one you can go to, and like, he can kind of help you out. And that's like, you know, from just like very basic troubleshooting, right? Or even video collection at a scene of crime, right? Like, I became very good at collecting video, right? And so this position came out, and I was still young on the service. Like, I had six years on, and I knew that, like, you know, seniority is a very big thing, and I respected that. And I was just like, I'm going to put my resume in because I want you to know that I exist. Hey, right. It's been 6 years, and I just want to make sure that, you know, hey, I have some computer. And with no real expectations of getting it, but they got it. And then I got the phone call and saying, hey, congratulations. You're going to be the first cybercrime detective and detective constable in Hamilton. And that was another great moment, right? I still feel kind of like the shivers that kind of go up and fill your face. Just whenever that, it was great. Right. So, I was really able to kind of put all of my education, right? So the computer programming background went hand in hand with my sociology and criminology. And I was just like, okay, that's a win. Who can often say that their education is really being used in their current career, right?
Yeah.
That's how that happened. And so after 6 years, I transferred into the Investigative Services Division. And I started assisting the sergeant who actually created the unit. He had the idea, put the proposal forward, and that's how the position was created. And now we're here today, you know, being able to really support Hamilton with computer-related crimes.
Yeah. I just want to go back for a second that a lot of times in a profession, you know, you get your education and your training and it's kind of one and done. But it seems to me in your profession, it is constant upgrading of skills provided, which is pretty impressive. Why do you think that's so important to have so much ongoing education within the police force?
It's personal development, right? First, it's a commitment to lifelong learning, right? It's very important too. I mean, if I'm the person who you're coming to with a computer related crime, or let's just say any crime, right? You want to speak with someone who is informed, who's up to date on the latest. And for me, in my particular situation, latest technology, familiar with applications being used, how things are done, so that, you know, your victim doesn't have to explain things to you in the form of like, this is how this technology works. I'm already on the same page as them, and I can kind of start absorbing more of how they were victimized. So I think in that sense, that's how education really comes out, because it's that interaction between the victim and the police service, which happens to be me in those situations, that really matters, right? Like an informed person who can kind of really understand where you're coming from. I think that's like an invaluable asset. I think that is huge to have someone who is passionate about that topic, right? And it worked out for me so well. So,
are you ever taken aback by sort of the lack of respect towards the profession? Because that is there, Kat.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, especially now, I think it's a bit of like it's an issue. And of course, like I take it upon myself. It's my job with every interaction to prove that that is not how it should be, right? I treat people who I speak with respect. I just, you know, how I act is how I view the police service. And then that is in a respectful manner. I'm happy whenever I talk to people. I truly believe that people, when they kind of report things to me, that they can hear that, like, I understand. And I feel the pain that they're feeling, you know, in that respect. And I think that really allows that victim to start their process of recovery, you know, whether it be mental and then also criminal part, right? The investigation that ensues. But yeah, there is a lot of, you know, anger towards police right now. And I do my part. I treat people as well as they can be. And I just take it from there, right?
Yeah, it's sort of like one of the things that I really like is all we can do is handle what's at our arm's length.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And if everybody does that appropriately, then that's all we can really ask, right? So,
and that's the key part, is if everyone does their part, right? So,
yeah. So talk to me about cybercrime. I think I know what it is, but maybe you tell me what it is from your point of view.
Well, cybercrime is, like, I guess there's kind of like two prongs to cybercrime. So there's crime that is committed with technology, right? So that's those people, like, using their phones to call and kind of defraud you, right? Or like using applications to defraud you. So that's kind of like all of like the kind of frauds, all of the old school crimes that are just being used with technology. Then there's another prong, which is like the very interesting stuff for me, which is where technology is the target. And that's like that's people hacking. They're getting into networks. Then they're doing mischief to data. So they're kind of, they're changing data. They're taking data or they're deleting data. So there's two kind of approaches to cybercrime. And currently, I mean, there's one person in this unit, and that's me. You know, all these come in and we get to investigate like very interesting uses of technology in crime, right?
So when companies or organizations are held for ransom because of a hacker, is that something that you would get involved with?
Yes. And now we would get involved in so much as we would take the report. And if it's reported quickly, which is very, very important for ransomware investigations, then there's something that we can do. You know, we can start getting the computer logs, like the little breadcrumbs of evidence that we can start collecting and hopefully form an investigation. Often, though, these crimes are not reported right away. Could be 2 weeks, a month, maybe like 6 months or something like that. And by then, all the evidence has been trampled over, or it's been deleted and reformatted, and they're back up and running and they're just reporting now. So it's very difficult to get into an investigation once all of that has happened. So it becomes almost like a reporting feature for the older reported cases. But I think the community, especially like in Hamilton, they're starting to get into the fact that, you know, cyber crimes can be reported, and, you know, there are avenues in which police can assist. So
do you think Ken, that there's a level of embarrassment on the part of the victim?
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of these are kind of romance scams, you know, where people are, like, they build that rapport with the threat actor, and then they start giving money to this person for bills, medical bills. They've never met them before, but that happens, and bills get built up. Like we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars that one person can be defrauded, and that's their life savings. They might be remortgaging their house to support someone else who just disappears, you know, after they've received the money. And the embarrassment is there, and I can understand that, right?
Yeah.
But you know, having that person on the other end of the phone whenever they're reporting it, you know, obviously taking this seriously and, you know, giving them some hope that, you know, we're going to look into this and we're going to try and see if, A, we could get your money back, or maybe we could hold someone accountable for their actions. That can kind of help with the embarrassment and help with that process again of like moving forward and starting to heal from the wrong that's been done to them. Right. So
yeah,
I can definitely see the embarrassment.
So Ken, did you watch the Tinder Swindler?
I haven't yet. I can't wait to see it. It's actually been screenshotted in a few of my presentations that I've attended, but yeah, what do you think? Should I watch it or?
Well, you should watch it. It's
okay.
It's very discouraging because, you know, people are so vulnerable,
vulnerable,
you know, and I think that people that are confidence people, con people, have such a skill set.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know
they're
where
good,
they get their
they
training.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like how do they get trained to be so good at talking people out of their money? It's just astounding and very sad.
Yeah. Use that ability to communicate for bad. Like, could you imagine, and I've heard this before, but like, could you imagine what they could achieve if they did it for good? Right. I mean, like they could do so much more, but no, they're behind a computer and they're defrauding people. And they're making promises to people who are lonely and vulnerable, right? And that's, and I mean, it's not just like younger age groups either. I mean, like our elderly population are being targeted by this too. And that breaks my heart every time I hear of, you know, a grandma or grandpa who has been defrauded or extorted. It's sad. And often in those cases, that's the money that they're living off of now, because they're finished their career and they're in retirement now. And all that money that they spent so many years building up is gone. It hurts me.
Yeah. So in December of last year, you won an award as Cyber Investigations Contributor of the Year from the International Association of Financial Crimes Investigators. Wow. So that's congratulations. You must. I mean, that's just incredible and amazing. So why did you win that award?
Okay. So I won that award just for an investigation that I was a part of. I was the lead investigator on that. And it's still before the courts currently. But there are some like news articles about it where a youth had stolen $48 million worth of cryptocurrency from a victim. And it was a big case. It was a very big case, but for that investigation, but also for contributing to the education of cybercrime. So doing presentations to service, kind of like informing the front line of, hey, cybercrime's here. We can do these things. These are avenues that are available to you if you receive, you know, word about this. But then also, you know, reaching out to, there's something with the YMCA, the City of Hamilton and Hamilton Police, where it was a youth engagement series. And we were able to reach out and kind of inform them about, you know, how to use social media, you know, not oversharing, if you have to share it all, right? A lot of like strategies on how to protect yourself as a youth, you know, in today's day and age growing up, if you're not on social media, often feels like you're not in the game at all, right? So just using social media in a responsible manner. So reaching out and doing things like that.
So do you talk to youth about sharing nude photos and so on?
Yeah. And that's something that's happening, and it's terrible because, you know, these photos are being shared between two people and maybe there's a relationship there. And this is kind of just this is how they are operating within their relationships. And it's a common thing. And then that relationship breaks down and one side is hurt. And that side, in order to like kind of like thrashes out and starts sharing those images, right? And there's charges under the criminal code for that now, right? And just if we could just get it through to youth that, you know, you don't need to be sharing these images, right? And this is a new phenomenon, especially for parents today, because like they never had to deal with that type of interaction between, you know, their son or daughter having to kind of be complicit in this behavior. But I think the message is out there. I think people understand that they shouldn't do it. But it comes down to being pressured into doing these things, right? And sometimes it turns out that those images don't get shared, but when it does, that's terrible. And also sometimes extortion too, right? People do it online with people they've never met, and then these images are shared, and then it's, you know, a threat to share it with everyone on their Facebook list unless you give me money or what have you. It's tough.
Yeah, it's a very sad phenomenon to me. And I think, well, that's because I guess I'm older. And as you said, in my youth, there was no such thing as that kind of, you would never have sort of taken a picture, gone and had the picture developed and then sent it to someone you were in a relationship with. That would just not have occurred to us. But I guess because of the speed and ability too of photography, that, you know, you don't maybe do the proper thinking, or as you said, I guess there's peer pressure and so on. I mean, there's always been peer pressure. That's since time immemorial, but that is sad. And I feel for parents that have to have that kind of discussion to try and relate to why it might be important for a youth to share, or an individual to share those kind of photos. Like, you know, where's parenting, there's no training to begin with, but, you know, how do you get trained for those kinds of conversations that are going to work?
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know the answer to that. Right.
Yeah.
But perhaps the answer starts with kind of having that conversation early, you know, and hopefully just building up that strength of character that you do not need to do this action in order to be accepted by this group or this person. Right.
Tough stuff.
It's something I'm going to have to go through soon, I'm sure, you know, like having those conversations, but not now.
Well, listen, congratulations on that award. That's really amazing and something to be so proud of. And that was just this past year, right? So you've had a busy life and continue to be a busy person, and now you're a dad. So what was that transition like for you, especially as you're a police officer? Because I think, does that mean he's just going to be so much more overprotective? Like what's that been like for you?
Well, the fear of being overprotective is real. That's for sure. You know what? Okay. So first of all, being a dad, phenomenal. This is great. I have a daughter, as I've mentioned, you know, she's 2 years old, and she's phenomenal. She, like, that meaning of love is right there, and it's right in her face every time I see it. But being a police officer and a parent is like you have an idea of like all the bad things that can happen. And so you kind of have to like allow her to explore the world, you know, make those mistakes within reason, and, you know, just, you have to battle your own mind, you know, from like, you know, protecting her so much versus just allowing her to kind of have those danger situations so that she knows not to do those things. Right. Yeah. I think that'll be a juggling act her entire life. Right. As I'm sure all parents would agree. Right. But yeah, being overprotective, I'm afraid.
I remember my daughter when she was your daughter's age, and she was walking and she opened the door and fell out of the house onto the cement. And so she was bleeding. And a friend of mine said, because I was so upset, and a friend of mine said, is this the first time she's fallen like that? And I thought, first time? Oh my gosh. There's so many more to go.
Yes.
And that's, that's life. That's being a parent. Anyway, I would think you'd be the most amazing dad.
Thank you. Thank you.
So we're going to switch now and talk about that your life went sideways, and that was related to health. And so can you take me through, first of all, when you started to wonder if there was something going on with your body and how things progressed?
Yeah. So it happened so quick. You know, my daughter at the time was 7 months old, and you know, life was good. I was doing some like really great things. You know, I was parenting. I felt like I was contributing to the team like as much as I could. You know, and the team being the marriage and like my daughter and everything like that. Right. I was also hitting like personal physical goals. Like I had just done like a 10 kilometer run for the first time. That was a goal of mine. I had done a 100 kilometer bike ride. That was another goal of mine. I felt great. I felt strong, physically, mentally. And you know, I was looking forward to everything, you know, with my wife and daughter and just having that whole experience. My work life was great because, I mean, being in a detective constable position, I was like a Monday to Friday, kind of 8 to 4 position. So I was able to be there at nighttime to like put her down to sleep and, you know, be there for dinner and like, you know, have those important moments. So life was going great. And, you know, I had a little bit of back pain, like in my lower back, and, you know, hindsight is 20/20. But that was, you know, maybe I'm just bending over too much on the bike. Right. And then eventually, you know, I stopped being able to go to the washroom. So my bladder wasn't able to void anymore. And that was the day where I went to the hospital and I just said, hey, something's up. So, you know, in the hospital, in the emergency room, they ended up putting like a bag catheter, and I was able to then empty my bladder. And, you know, they're thinking, oh, maybe this is prostatitis or something like this. And, you know, Googling that quickly came up with some, oh, well, bikers, like people who ride bicycles, they could get prostatitis, right? So here's some antibiotics and hopefully it'll get better, right? So, okay, cool. So we've got a solution to the problem. But that was just the beginning. That was my body just shutting down at that point. And it got worse. And let's also mention, you know, we're now doing this during a pandemic. So like, is this COVID, you know? And, you know, there was no respiratory issues. There was no, like, I don't have sniffles. I don't have any of like the common things, but then there was also those reports of, you know, people testing positive for COVID and not having any of those symptoms. Right. So, you know, tests for COVID were negative, and eventually it came down to, you know, I had to go into the shower almost every 20 minutes to get hot water just going down on my lower back, because my lower back was just on fire. And that moment, one of the times in the shower, I just fell out of the shower, and my legs just kind of gave out. And my wife, you know, we're trying to stay away from each other, right? Because what if this is COVID? We, you know, we still have to look after our daughter. So we were trying to isolate from each other, and I needed the shower, which there was one in our house at that time. And so she heard this, like, well, I'm like, you know, 6'3", you know, 230 pounds. So whenever I fell, I mean, like the earth shook. And so she came in, and, you know, and she's quite short. She's about 5'1", 5'2". She's like pulling me up out of the shower, off the floor. And that, like, our world changed at that moment. And, you know, to add a little bit of levity to the situation, you know, I'm just like, you know what? I just need eggs. Can you make me some eggs? I'm going to feel better if I just had some eggs. That was always the solution growing up, you know, have some eggs and then you'll feel better. You can go to school. So, you know, she gets me into bed, my legs are not working anymore. And, that's whenever she's just like, I've had enough here. I'm calling, you know, 911. And, the ambulance came. You know, they I guess at that time my legs were like in and out of working. So I was, they were able to kind of like, you know, put their arms around me and get me down the stairs and got me onto the stretcher and took me to the hospital. They ended up finding out later on down the road that I had a condition, I guess, called, this is a long, long word, but extensive longitudinal transverse myelitis. So it, like if you were to look at an MRI of my spine at that time, it was like I was in a horrific car accident. So, you know, they're asking like, were you in an accident? Did you fall? I mean, I fell out of the shower, but yeah, it wasn't terrible, you know, horrific fall. But my spine was, I had a spinal cord injury. I have a spinal cord injury. And I couldn't move my legs at all. I was just bedridden. And my bowels were shut down. My bladder was shut down. So I had a catheter in. And I also had something called an NG tube, where there was something like up through my nose and then down into my stomach that was constantly taking things out of my stomach that didn't need to be there at that time. I couldn't eat anymore. So they had a PICC line in me that was giving me like this, like it was in one of those bags that you see on like attached to the gurney. And that's how I got like food and everything like that.
And how long did that go on, that period of time?
Well, I guess as soon as I got to the hospital, like that was whenever it was at its worst. Couldn't move my legs, couldn't feel. Whenever I could feel, felt like my skin was on fire. So this is a weird way to articulate it, but you know, my hands gave out also. Like there was paralysis in my arms at a certain point. And like, you know, breaks my heart to say this, but my wife, you know, she would be by my side and console me and like hold my hand. And I had to tell her like, don't hold my hand, because it felt like my hand was like on fire. It was numb. It was burning, all these things all mixed into one. It was terrible. How long did it go on? Far too long. but I guess part of the treatment for that was they hooked me up to this machine that was going to give me like a transfusion. So 10 days worth of steroids and plasma. And so they were just kind of circulating this in and out of my body for 10 days. And then eventually, you know, I could move my toe, my big toe, which was like massive. I mean, like I've, you know, with technology and everything like that, you know, you've got memories that pop up on your phone. And, you know, this is what happened to you like 6 months ago, 1 year ago. And that video of me doing that comes up, you know, moving my toes, and joy was just so amazing, you know.
But can I ask you, yeah. did you ever at any point think I'm going to die?
Like looking back, I think no, there was no I'm going to die. I think the people around me, there's, you know, maybe like there's a possibility maybe, but I don't think like that wasn't what I was willing to accept. My perspective, and keep in mind, like I was being pumped full of drugs, and like they're involved and things like this, but that just wasn't an option. Dying wasn't on the table. That wasn't there. You know, being told that like you're not going to walk, that was something that lit a fire. That, I mean, like the fire was going before this, but like, you know, perhaps you should start picking out, you know, a wheelchair, or thinking about like, you know, life in a wheelchair, right? Those were big things to start adjusting, you know, your entire life plan, right? Having like an active lifestyle, and then going down to not having necessarily an active lifestyle, being in a wheelchair, that was scary, right? Horrific, in fact. Like it shatters your world. Like let's be real, that shatters your world.
Yeah. How did you stay you then? And because this is what I'm hearing, that you stayed you. And it's the person that you were talking about when you were saying about at the beginning of each of your martial arts sessions, you had a mantra and everybody had a mantra and so on. You obviously are an incredibly strong person. How did you stay being you?
It's not something that I had to like try, right? Because like you said, like from day one, like early on in my development, I'm building like this resilience, right? I'm building it. And it's part of my character, right? It's part of who I am. Just how did I stay me? Like, I mean, I had like my wife by my side. You know, she was there. I saw it in her eyes all the time. You know, just how hurt she was from this experience. You know, having my mom there too. Like, there's only two people who are allowed to see me in the hospital, right? And you know, they would rotate coming in. You know, and just to be with me and everything like that. And I'm sure there was like down times, right? But it's just not in me to be defeated. That's not an option. Right. And it's not like, you know, I have choices in front of me and it's like, well, I could be defeated or I can't be defeated. It was just, there is no defeat here. Right.
Yeah.
You know, it's really hard to say how I stayed me, but it's just, I can say it wasn't an option to not be me. So, that was it. And like my wife, she even said it too. She was like, she was worried that this event would change me. Right. And she's like, I can accept, you know, you being in a wheelchair, I can accept all these changes for you. But the kind of that silver lining is that I was still Ken, you know,
yeah.
I was still joking with her. I was still pranking and I was still positive. Like I was still me. Right.
Yeah.
So, it just, my entire life led to that moment of, well, if this is the way it's going to be, this is the way it's going to be, but I'm still me. So, yeah.
Did you pick out a wheelchair?
Yeah. And, you know, I was looking at other cool ones that could go like, you know, off-roading, right? So you could go on trails because even like, you know, with my daughter and wife, like we would go to the conservation. And we would, I'd have my daughter strapped to my chest and we'd go on like these hikes and my daughter would be passed out, you know, it was great. Right. And we were still active. We were out in the sun. We were, you know, it was great. And I was like, well, you know, this is going to continue. So I'm going to need to get a wheelchair that can go off road. Right. And then, you know, I started looking at, you know, vehicles that could, you know, get wheelchairs in and everything like that. And then the Ontario Spinal Cord Injury, I think it's an association, but they had a representative come and this gentleman, he was in a wheelchair. He drove there. He can get in and out of a car. And, you know, like I started looking at people who would be like me and I was like, okay, if they can do it, I can do it. You know, this is just going to be one of those things. I'm going to be in a wheelchair. But I'm going to do everything I did before in a wheelchair.
Yeah. Are you in a wheelchair, Ken?
No, I'm not. I'm walking around. I've got goals to do like a 5-kilometer run. That's where I'm going to top out. Like I'm just okay with the 5K. I've been out, you know, in the past week, you know, doing something with it. You know, it's usually called a couch to 5K program. I'm going to do wheelchair to 5K program and I'm going to do that 5K. I can walk and I've got the ability to do this, right? I'm pretty recovered as far as it goes, right? Like I have like some issues with, well, actually I have like some big issues, right? Like I don't have control over my bladder. I don't have control over my bowels. So I have routines to do that. And, you know, life is different in that sense, but, you know, it's invisible now. Right. So,
yeah. You must be so amazed though at the power of your body. and, you know, how it's trying to do its best.
Absolutely. Yeah. And its ability to bounce back. Right.
Yeah.
Quite honestly, looking back, maybe I was preparing for this type of injury, right? Like going on those bike rides, going on those runs, being strong to do that physically. You know, I believe I have the mental strength to get through this, and I definitely had the physical strength to get through it.
Yeah. So. It's an amazing story, and it is such a story of resilience and I think appreciation too of life and what we have, and is, you know, your wife and your daughter and your mom and your family and so on. These things really make us appreciate everything.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm regularly turning to my wife and I'll smile. She'll smile. She knows what's on my mind, and we'll both at the same time say, like, we are so lucky. You know, I mean, like, we're often just looking at our daughter saying that, but like, then we kind of reflect on our experience. And, you know, I know that I had the injury, but like, I truly think that like my wife had the short end of that. You know, she's the one who had so much to go through. She had a husband who had, and we didn't know what was wrong with me. We still don't know what caused all of this. It was a virus that my body just kind of saw and then attacked and continued and just attacked my entire spinal cord. But she had to deal with that, plus a 7-month-old baby, and then pandemic, and then not being able to see me like on a regular kind of situation. Okay. So I had some issues. She went through so much, and she's the strong one, you know?
Well, that's the thing, right? We stand by the people we love, and that's what we do. And that's what she did. And I'm sure in many ways it was an honor. Remember that. Yeah. How long were you off work?
So I was, work has been so amazing to me. I was in the hospital for 3 months. And when I got out of the hospital, I had a walker. The silver one that has the slides, and then also a wheelie walker that you could kind of turn around and sit on. So that's how I got out of the hospital. And then there was about 3 months of me being at home and kind of getting acclimatized to like this whole situation, possibly dealing with just limited mobility, and then continuing to go through rehab. So 6 months, then I got a phone call from my sergeant, and he was just like, hey, listen, if you are ready, you know, we have the ability to allow you to work from home, right? And my sergeant at the time, like, he knew that like I'm a worker, right? I gotta have something to do. And he's just like, if you're open to it, there's no pressure, you know, like if you're open to it, you can work from home. We could use you, and I'm sure you could use us, right? So I had a very like long conversation with my wife, and I was just like, is this something that like, you know, hey, you're comfortable with? And you know, we both decided that like, yeah, this is something we can do. And especially like part of the recovery, you know, to like start taking that next step. It was quick, but it was within my realm of comfort, and also my family's realm of comfort. So, we got set up. So it was about 6 months, and, I was off sick, and then I started coming back modified, working from home. And then after that, I got an opportunity to be the acting sergeant of the technological crime unit. And so I was able to do that for another 6 months. And I actually came back to work, and that was difficult because, you know, at that point, you know, I was finished, rehabilitation. The rehab doctor was just like, you're good to be discharged to continue your own rehab. And like they were confident that I was able to continue just because of my own drive. They understood that like, I'm not going to sit still, you know? So going back to work and just walking down the halls and seeing people who had reached out, signed cards, send me the texts. I mean, like it was an emotional journey, right? Like from the entire moment. And, you know, I still feel emotional about the entire thing, you know? But yeah, it was almost a year, right, before I was able to get back to this state of walking around and, you know, driving and doing all these things.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, isn't it, about work, because lots of times we denigrate work because, you know, well, it's called work. It's not called fun, but work does a lot for us. It just does. It there's just something that occasionally I think it's a good idea to appreciate work and having to use your mind or having to use your hands or having to do something that contributes in some sort of way. And that's your work and that's you doing your work. It's powerful.
It truly is. It truly is. Especially like, I love my job, you know, it's just so satisfying and it's a challenge. You know, you get these little challenges and you get to peel apart and you kind of get to figure out the inner workings, and it's a puzzle, you know, and it's absolutely, it's rewarding for sure.
Yeah, it is. So Ken, I have my three questions that I sent you. Are you still good to answer my questions? My three?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So my first question is, what has been the best advice you've received?
So I've kind of grilled myself about this question, and I want to say that it's probably from one of my coach officers. I can't tell you which one, but it was to tell the truth, right? And obviously, like to get where I've gotten, I haven't like made a habit of lying and things like this, but really, you know, owning your mistakes was what I took away from that.
Yeah.
And, you know, just immediately, right? Like you make a mistake, own up to it. And what are we going to do about it to A, if it needs to be fixed, or what are we going to learn from it so that we don't make mistakes again? You know, and the more you kind of, you do this, the easier it is to stand up and be like, yep, that's my fault. And this is what I did. This is what was wrong. And this is what I learned from it. Right.
Yeah.
It's so important. It actually, and especially in my line of work, like if you make a mistake, you need to own it quickly. Or else that just becomes a whole other story. Right. But, absolutely. Just own your mistakes. Right. Yeah.
Okay. That's a good one. Secondly, is there a book that you've read that has influenced you or helped you?
Yes. So we talked earlier about, you know, being mentally prepared, especially for being a police officer. And I was lucky enough to become a police officer in the era of acknowledging the fact that, you know, you need mental hardening and strength and a strategy. So when I got hired, there was a book that was given to us to read and to share with our family, because this was, I mean, a mental health strategy isn't, you know, a solo, like a solo effort. It takes a community, right? So the book is called Emotional Survival for Law Enforcement, and it's by Dr. Gil Martin. And one of the analogies that comes from that book that really, really helped me was that, you know, you don't just get injured from, well, I mean, of course you can, you don't just get injured from one event. It's possible, but you know, throughout your career, you're going to pick up these little pebbles, and those little pebbles are going to be tiny little injuries, and you're going to put those in your backpack. And after 25, 30 years, you've picked up so many pebbles, and so many, some are bigger, some are smaller, that you have in your backpack, that it is just so heavy. And for one person to carry that is so difficult. And it's so important to kind of offload those pebbles and the big rocks as you go, and you offload them through communication. And that's how I do it, is through communication. You know, speaking to, you know, your loved ones, your mother, your wife, your coworkers, and then also kind of dealing with it physically too, right? Getting your workouts in, running, biking, doing whatever kind of empties your tank and gets your mind in that kind of Zen area is so important. And so this book really kind of, it articulated it, and like, obviously you have to have a strategy, but like, which one are you going to choose? Which one do you have? Right. And so it just made it super important to me to speak with people about, all these hard things that I've experienced. Right. So, that book definitely helped.
Finally, my third question is, what advice would you give your younger self?
This one, this is so hard. So I don't think I would want to tell myself anything, because knowing myself, I would use that as something that would reaffirm my future, right? So if I said everything's going to be okay, then maybe I wouldn't try as hard, or maybe those moments of fear and grind to obtain what I wanted to achieve might not happen. You know what, maybe, and this a little bit of like humor, but like, maybe I'd say like, don't use so much gel, right? Because like it might affect something, right? I wouldn't want to risk affecting my decisions by telling myself that it's going to be okay, or don't do this or don't do that. I've arrived at this stage in my life, being 35 years old. I'm so satisfied with my life. I've got an amazing wife. I've got an amazing daughter, got an amazing career. I've got an amazing family. I've got so much to be thankful for that I'd just be so worried to change it.
I see. To mess with the formula.
Yeah. Right. And it's worked. So I just stand back and maybe watch and just be like, hey, I remember that. And then that's good enough for me. But maybe just lay off the gel a little bit.
That's a great one. That's great to hear. I think that's everything that I wanted to chat about. And I so appreciate you chatting about. Is there anything that you want to add before we wrap up?
I think if anyone who's listening, wants to have a rewarding career, the negative view of policing aside, it's an amazing career. Right? You can do so much in policing. I think it's still a very, very great career. And it's rewarding. So I think like anyone who's looking to be a police officer or make that career change and go into policing, if they're considering it, I think it's a great idea. I think it's absolutely a great idea. So I think that's all I...
Yep. Let me just say that... For the most part, I just think it's an incredibly important profession. And we're so appreciative of having that serve and protect, because that's how lucky are we, right? So anyway, thank you so much for joining me today, Ken. I really appreciate this conversation.
Absolutely. So did I. Thank you so much for having me on here. Thank you for the invite. It's great. Thank you so much.
Okay. And to our viewers and listeners, this has been quite a conversation with Ken. And I hope that you take out of it many things. I certainly have. The resilience of people is just astounding and so impressive. I know we need to have it, but it's wonderful to see examples of great people who have been and are resilient. So wonderful to chat with Ken today. Please follow me on YouTube and listen wherever you get your podcasts, and check out my website, career-resilience.com, where there's more about me and all the interviews that I've done so far. So until we meet again, thanks.